Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That is a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, and this is the second part of a two-part conversation with Métis storyteller and current Montana Poet Laureate Chris Latray, author of Becoming Little Shell, A Landless Indian's Journey Home. If you haven't yet listened to the first part of our conversation, I recommend you do so. You can find that episode and all Right Question episodes online at mtpr.org and wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And now, the second half of my conversation with Chris Latray.
The remains of that tree, and I was thinking, this feels like taking care of the body of a relative who has crossed over. And I wanted to be part of that. I didn't want somebody else to come up and disappear these remains. I wanted to have a hands-on relationship with that. And that changes when you start thinking like that. I think that changes how you want to interact with the world around you. And you know, that's a very indigenous concept. And more people, I think, are coming to recognize that. And that's important.
Not all of Missoula will probably contextualize that storm in the way that you have. But it did seem to me that people became aware again of the space that they share, right?
Yes.
Like neighbors became neighbors again. And we all were very, very conscious of, and this sounds so silly maybe, but we were conscious of the trees.
Yeah.
And that's something that we lose in the day-to-day often. And so while we might not contextualize it in the way that you have here, I think we were all aware again of the space that we share with each other and of, you know, the natural space as well. Yeah.
And also what they are providing us.
Absolutely.
You know, whether it's shade or beauty or any of those things, they are giving and giving and giving. What are we giving back? You know, what are we doing to participate in that reciprocal relationship?
Sure.
And you're right. I mean, after the storm blew through, after 20 minutes of just mayhem of, you know, I have never seen anything like this before. And then everybody in my community just kind of staggers out of their houses almost in a daze. And I was talking to neighbors I've never spoken to before. And you know, people who I know their dogs' names, but I don't know theirs.
Yeah.
You know, and how we rally together. Like, I'm amazed at how quickly the various, you know, utility people got out and got power up and running. Like, out where I live on Mullen Road, which was just, it's like a tornado came through and just picked up every power pole and flung it. And
Hurricane
I was amazed,
winds, yeah.
Yes, how quickly it all came together. And I said, well, why can't we rally for other critical things? I spoke yesterday in front of a bunch of teachers at a teacher conference. How do we inspire those same people to recognize the dire straits that education is in and the funding and all of those? It's the same thing. Our future depends on our ability to raise our children. And we're doing a terrible job of recognizing that. And it's the same. Yeah, the storm happens. It happens fast. And the destruction is immediate and clearly obvious, whereas the destruction related to poor funding of schools and things is a long game. Well, the insidious parts of our culture rely on the long game because it's easy to distract us from that. And I just, you know, I look at that and I think, why does it have to be a disaster for us to rally? I don't think it has to be. And I like to think that maybe that's starting to change a little bit.
Yeah, I hope so too. You're speaking about the long game, and I'm going to go back to this idea of blood quantum, because you talk about blood quantum being both a settler colonial tool, but a tool for the long game of erasure of indigenous populations in this country. Will you speak to Blood Quantum, Chris? And I don't know if the question is to contextualize it within your own story, how you had to maneuver around it in your enrollment story, or if you just want to contextualize it historically. Either question, I think, is interesting, certainly.
Yeah. Well, Blood Quantum is genocide.
Yes.
So genocide is more than, you know, bodies stacked up in a pit, you know, that a bulldozer shoves earth over. Genocide isn't just a body count. It's the elimination of culture and language. So genocide, the boarding schools are an act of genocide. I think the unfolding genocide that attention is not being given to throw more money into like immersive language schools for indigenous communities to reclaim our languages. The fact that we're not doing that is genocide. Mm-hmm. But Blood Quantum, for those people who don't know, is the measure of so-called Indian blood that you have and whether or not you have enough to be enrolled in your tribal community. So most tribes, it's like a quarter blood you have to have, but it's arbitrary. It's been arbitrary from the very beginning.
It was something that, again, the U.S. government insisted that tribes use in order to create these boundaries, and then the tribes themselves have, I don't know if insisted on, but they have certainly used themselves to kind of cement these boundaries. How would you better articulate that?
In some cases, they've insisted on it, you know, because the people I trust least on any Indian community are the tribal governments, because they're not how we traditionally do things, certainly
right.
Not mine. You know, they're this structure that was handed over to them by the federal government.
Mm.
And you have people just like anywhere else who are out for themselves. The idea being that say you have some resource that you share, and let's say there's a money base to it. The more people you have enrolled that you have to share that wealth with, the less it is for each individual. And that becomes, a thing that we didn't care about traditionally, because there wasn't wealth that we were sharing. Our wealth was, you know, all the intangible things that you really can't put a dollar value on. And it's bogus. And I even almost sometimes resent isn't even the right word. I'm cognizant of the fact that I am an enrolled, air quotes, member of the little shell, which
uh-huh.
means I meet the Blood Quantum requirements to be enrolled. But there are plenty of people who are every bit as little shell as I am, whose Blood Quantum does not allow them to be enrolled. And I am like motivated to just rip Blood Quantum as an enrolled member benefiting from it, because it gives me a position to say, yeah, I have been privileged to have this, but it still sucks. If I wasn't enrolled, then I just sound like someone with sour grapes because I can't get, air quotes again, enrolled. And
right.
it's important, and it's horrible. It's the long game genocide nature of it is that eventually over time, because of how much of a mixed community we are, you know, nobody's full blood anything, anywhere really. And the law over time, you don't have enough people who can qualify to be enrolled with the tribe, and eventually they go away.
Yeah.
And that's the long game nature of it. And we're really only a few generations away in certain tribes, and that needs to be changed.
Yeah.
And it will change, you know? We'll figure it out. Like in Red Lake, the Red Lake Ojibwe, who have maintained more sovereignty than just about any tribe in the United States,
mm-hmm.
a couple years ago, they reset their blood quantum saying, okay, you know, anybody who was born on this date or earlier, we're going to now say was full blood. And then
right.
anybody that came after them, their whole blood quantum got reset. As they, you know, they're trying to decide, okay, how do we want to deal with this in the future? Well, as a stopgap, we're just going to reestablish what everybody alive today's blood quantum is to give us that much more time to figure it out.
My impulse or my reaction to that is that they're still operating within this system. And what would that look like if, you know, the tribes gave it up? You
mm-hmm.
know, it would probably just be, and I can't say this definitively, but it just seems like there would be like open kinship, right? You
yeah.
know? Chris, I want to pivot from what is kind of a dark matter, but certainly very much a reality of your memoir and your heritage. But I do want to pivot. You mentioned One Robe. You mentioned Nick Vrooman. Let's talk about this man whose legacy here in Montana and whose work with the Little Shell is so integral to their enrollment, as you note in the book. Tell me about Nick, who he was to you, and who he is to the Little Shell Chippewa.
So for me, Nicholas was kind of a mentor. So when I met him in 2013, when his One Robe book came out, and, you know, I opened it up, and I was already starting to hear about the Little Shell and that they were Chippewa, and I thought that that is likely where my family came from. So when his book came out and I picked it up and I see a bunch of Donies, which is my grandmother's family's name, and a bunch of Latres in the index, all of these people that we supposedly weren't related to, you know, in the 20 minutes of his presentation, I learned more about where we came from than I'd known, you know, up to my, for my entire life up to that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, he just became very enthusiastically supportive of me writing this story, even though it took a couple years for me to really get my legs under me and overcome all of the kind of self-doubt and all of that that came with this revelation. What he was to me, he was to many people, both as, you know, Little Shell folks returning their heritage. He was really into music, so he would go out and make essentially these field recordings because he was a folklorist. That was his kind of his vocation. He was the
second in Montana.
Yeah, second and the first in North Dakota, I believe.
Yeah.
And he went back to school to get a PhD in history. Not because he cared about that, but because he knew that what he was learning would carry more weight if he had that doctorate to say this is actually true, where people, you know, turn their noses up. Academia being a whole nother topic.
But sure.
Yeah, so he was that to so many people and made such a huge impact. And I don't think we would have gotten federally recognized or federally restored, as we call it now, without his work. I mean, we would have eventually, but it just would have just taken a lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not even in my lifetime.
Sure. And his work, although we can certainly categorize it as academic a little bit, but The Whole Country Was One Robe is now this sort of, it feels like a living document of the Little Shell history.
It is, and it is very academic. So one of the things I wanted to do with Becoming Little Shell was take our history and kind of rewrite it in a way that's more accessible to people. I mean, One Robe is like, it's a hard read, and I wanted my book to be, my book stands firmly on the shoulders of Nicholas's work. You know, he was my primary source of information, or at least a source of who to talk to go deeper and get more personalized information. And that's what I wanted, is to be able to take what he had done and make it so people like me who were looking for a return to where they came from have a little bit easier path to follow.
Chris, I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about or touch on briefly even Métis fiddling. Can we talk about this style of music and its role in the book and in your life now?
So the fiddle was adopted early on in the creation of this culture as part of that blend that I talked about, where the Métis were this blend of everything that the folks who were being born from these marriages enjoyed. And the fiddle, you know, that's an instrument that travels well because it's light. And, you know, we were a festive people and we liked to have a good time. And the fiddle was part of that. And it's just, you know, and jig dancing, which is the high knee stepping, very vigorous, you know, European sourced and evolved somewhat differently in our culture. So it's been part of our community since the early onset of who we became.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, you know, like I'll go out to Lewistown over Labor Day weekend and there's a big Métis festival, and the first night will be fiddling and jig dancing, and then the next day will be what we, you know, around Montana who have ever gone to a powwow expect to see, with the grand entrance and the drums and the regalia and all that stuff. So we are both, and we have, you know, some of my elders that say, you know, I don't know about those powwows. I like the fiddling and all that, and you know, my preference. Don't tell Al Wiseman, but who's our elder in Shodo, but I like the drums and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I like the primal nature of just that thunderous beat and the singing and the pageantry of the regalia and all that. I love a good fiddle tune here and there too, but you know, I think I think the fiddling in the soundtrack of the Last of the Mohicans movie is probably the soundtrack of this book because I listen to it so much.
Sure.
You know, but
yeah.
But yeah, it's I think it's fascinating.
We're talking about the fact that this memoir is both personal and cultural history, basically, right? Was there difficulty in approaching the personal after obviously doing so much research and on-the-ground interviews of the cultural? Was it difficult to dive into your specific family's past and history?
It was. So, you know, originally I kind of wanted this to be my dad's story, but, you know, I don't know anything about his youth because he never talked about it. And it came apparent pretty early that while there are similarities, you know, my dad's story is similar to so many stories of his generation across, you know, among all tribal communities, that trauma and that wanting to distance and that wanting to deny who you are. And so the first draft of this book was more of a like narrative nonfiction history type thing. You know, like I love Peter Stark's work, you know, where he just goes in and he's referencing letters and quoting these people. And I love that kind of thing. And I think the first draft was more along those lines. It was much more deeply engaged with the history and dates and facts and things like that. And when I turned it in to Milkweed, my editor there, Daniel Slager, said, yeah, this is great, but we need more of you in it. And I was like, oh my God, I knew you were going to say that. So, and that was hard. The second draft was really hard because, you know, I make a point not really to talk about my personal life too much, even though, you know, even with my poetry and stuff, it seems personal and it is, but there's a wall between certain things and there's certain things I don't want to talk about. And even like when I get asked out to dinner after I do an event, people start wanting to ask about my family and all that stuff. I don't want to talk about it. It's not my business to put, you know, anecdotes about my family out without them having a say in what gets shared and what doesn't. So I just don't. Mm-hmm. And I think I get that from my dad. He was deeply personal. And if any kind of a question that you would ask and if he thought was crossing the line, it was pretty apparent that he feels that you crossed the line.
He'd get angry.
He would, yeah. Or there was just a way you knew when he was angry. And I've inherited some of that. So it was hard for me to go in and then kind of dig into things and put that stuff on the page. And it was way more difficult than I thought it was going to be.
You're listening to a conversation with Métis storyteller and current Montana Poet Laureate, Chris Latray. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Fact and Fiction, an independent bookstore located in the heart of downtown Missoula, Montana, providing books for all ages and supporting the literary community in Montana and beyond. More information can be found at factandfictionbooks.com. I mean, this is a question. It's a personal question, but it maybe is both also a craft question, Chris. How does your memoir address grief? And it might not be grief specifically. Again, your grandfather's death, your father's death, they catalyzed this project for you, or at least this journey for you. And the story of the Little Shell Chippewa, their displacement, their landlessness, there's implicit grief there. I'm wondering if you intentionally approached grief or how you see this book addressing grief.
That is a very wise question, Lauren, and no one has asked me that. And I would say, you know, if pride was the air I was breathing, grief was what I was exhaling. So it's very much part of the whole story. And I'm in a constant state of grief over it. You know, just recently, during doing interviews and stuff for this, because you know, I'm fortunate to be poet laureate at the time that this book is coming out, and the two definitely inform and enhance the experience of each other. Mm-hmm. And people will ask me, do you write your poetry in your native language or in English first? And I immediately begin to feel guilt. Explainably, but you know, unusually maybe, that I can't write in my native language. And I don't think a lot of people understand how disconnected most tribes are from our traditional languages. Mm-hmm. And that is grief. And it really bums me out that that I can't. And all of the things that fuel that, all of the things that fuel that, you know, the little shell, we're basically reestablishing our connection to who we have always been because we had to shove that all underground for several generations. And now there are people who want our cultural ceremonies and who want our cultural ways of knowing and all of those things. And well, who do we go to get that?
Hmm.
You know, especially living as a diaspora all spread out. And that is grief. So grief is on every page, even if it's not being, you know, drawn specific attention to.
Who are you learning the language from? Who do you seek out or who do you look to? Because you are, you know, you are slowly learning,
yeah,
relearning the language. Your body is relearning the language of the little shell. Who do you look to?
Probably my main source for it is this guy who's got a great YouTube account and a great Instagram account. He is also of Turtle Mountain descent. His name is James Vukelich Kagagabo. And I'm sure people listening to that, I follow that guy because he's got thousands and thousands and thousands. And he's just such a kind and generous sharer of that knowledge and those words. And I got to meet him just a couple months ago. And, you know, we've formed a friendship because our stories are similar in how we came to know where we come from. And, you know, language is one of those things, too, that, you know, I learn a when I want to know a word, there's a great online Ojibwe dictionary that Kagagabo was part of creating. And I go there and I look up words and I try and remember them and then I forget them and then I have to look them up again. And it's just a practice of relearning and relearning, because unless you're immersed in it and you're not around it, it's very difficult to pick up a language. So it's just words at a time, words at a time. And I get – people will ask me, you know, is it okay for me to say – use this language, you know, as a white person? And I say, of course it is. If you go to France, don't you feel obligated to learn some French so that you can interact with the people whose land you're on? How's that different here? You know, if you live in Missoula, I think you should learn how to say hello and goodbye and order your coffee perhaps in Salish. And if you – admire the work I do as an Anishinaabe person, then yes, learn our language. Help us, you know, help us return to it so that we can hear it. You know, Robin Wall Kimmerer, who wrote Braiding Sweetgrass, who I think has done more for kind of, you know, sharing Anishinaabe worldview with the world than anybody else right now. Her and Vukelich, I think, are the ones who have done the most. But I was fortunate to spend a day with her when she was in Missoula last fall. And I picked her up at her hotel room, at her hotel. And I'm waiting in the lobby and I saw her coming and she had a very questioning look on her face because she had no idea what I looked like.
Uh-huh.
And as she approached, I said, Robin, bonjour. And the way her face lit up to hear her language spoken in this place that she probably never would have expected to hear it, that means a lot. And I was happy to have that moment with her.
I think it's also important not only for others to use the language, but when I was reading your book, Chris, one thing that became so striking to me was the fact that we need to know these stories.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we need to know this history. I am from Montana. I grew up here. And so much of your book was news to me. Right?
Yes.
Like that is, this is a Montana history that everyone in this state should read. I feel like this should be required reading. But also everyone, I feel like this is a history that needs to be told. So not only does the language need to be revitalized, but the number of people telling these stories too.
Yeah. Well, and we're fortunate in Montana, you know, at the state level, our constitution mandates that kids be taught. It's Indian education for all. And it's been off, even though, you know, what was it, 1970, whatever, that the Constitution was written. And there's been, like in the 90s, the late 90s, it was kind of readdressed. And just in the last year, it's been readdressed even more, the requirement that teachers teach Indian Ed for all students, mm-hmm. K through university.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing where, you know, when it comes to language, if you know one word, you should say it. And then you learn two words. Now you can say two and then five. Teachers can get overwhelmed in like, well, I'm supposed to teach all this history. I don't even know where to start, so I'm not even going to. It's like that odious task where you do it and then all of a sudden it's like, well, that wasn't so bad. I tell teachers when I'm asked to speak, it's like, learn one thing. Teach that one thing in a class, and then maybe next year you'll have two. It's just those tiny little steps because, again, it's the long game. Mm-hmm. You know, because I'm the same as you. You know, I grew up in Frenchtown, you know, half a dozen miles from Council Grove where the Treaty of Hellgate Treaty of 1855 was signed, knowing nothing about it. And I don't blame my teachers for that because chances are they didn't know anything about it either. So it's so much better now than it was then, yeah. At least in pockets. We can see those incremental changes, and everything changes incrementally.
Would you mind reading a passage from Becoming Little Shell?
Not at all. What's funny is just a couple days ago, I stopped at the First People's Buffalo Jump State Park, which is where this is set, and you know, looked in the room where this actually happened, and because I want – they have a great – bookstore in their gift shop, and now they carry Becoming Little Shell. So I'll just start reading. As a result of my curiosity and desire to find out if I'm enrolled, I experienced my first quarterly meeting of the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians during that steamy 2017 afternoon. I'm in the presence of several people I'll come to know as this project unfolds. Chairman Gerald Gray, for example, and Kim McKeon, who's sworn in as the council's newest member and will become one of my best friends. Dwayne Reed, whom we'll meet later, and finally, Nicholas Vrooman. I'm amazed he not only recognizes me, but greets me by name and asks how my project is going, even though a couple years have passed since we spoke. The meeting is a dry affair. The conference room off the foyer of the visitor center is cramped, but there aren't many folks in attendance. Previous meeting minutes are covered, current budget status is reported, and a few other pieces of news are discussed. It feels rushed, and it is, because everyone who wants to get it over with and head outside for the powwow. I'm distracted because I expect there will be some announcement of names of new enrollees, some kind of welcome, but that doesn't happen. Chairman Gray merely asks Linda Watson for an enrollment update, and she announces some numbers. And that's it. No names, no fanfare. The meeting adjourns. I stand a little stunned and disappointed. Then I find Linda Watson and introduce myself. I tell her I submitted an application and wonder if maybe she can tell me if I was on the list of those accepted for enrollment. She asks me my name. Latrae, I say. Chris Latrae. Yes, I remember your name, she says. Your application was accepted. You can expect a letter in the next month. I thank her, then walk to my car. In the open field beyond the parking lot next to a small RV, a small flock of ruffed grouse cluck about, scratching at the dirt and making short dashes that seem completely random. I smile at their antics, then burst into tears.
That was the second half of my conversation with Chris Latrae, author of the memoir Becoming Little Shell, A Landless Indian's Journey Home, out now from Milkweed Editions. To listen to the first part of our conversation, go to mtpr.org, where you can also listen to my live conversation with Chris during Montana Public Radio's Spring 2024 fundraiser. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.